at the Bull Run Roundtable, particularly when John gave me Mission Impossible tonight to talk of a period of about 6 months in the Civil War. First off, I want to say, in compliment to Martha Henley's remarks, yes, I did attend the first year of the Mosby production. I found it very interesting. It was a very pleasant night out there, and hopefully you can go see it this year and see them on their second year of running. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak for it. Now, what I'm going to speak about tonight is we're going to pick up the Army of Northern Virginia and the Army of the Potomac in August 1863. By that period, Lee's army, badly battered at the Battle of Gettysburg, percentage-wise, very heavy casualties, had retired into Culpeper County. By the 10th day of August, the army is beginning to be joined by men who had straggled, men who had had light wounds, and reinforcements, and was up to about 58,000. But of course, that is considerably below what they had on the eve of Gettysburg. By the 22nd of August, he's built the strength up to about 60,000. He then is going to go on a long meeting in Richmond, Virginia, with the President of the Confederacy to decide what they're going to do next. Lee would be in favor of, if he could get more reinforcements, which Davis doesn't believe he can give him, of taking the offensive again against the Federals. Lee is not in very good health. He's undoubtedly suffering from problems with the heart that will take his life on Columbus Day of 1870. So he is not his usual in good health, and will spend a considerable time riding in ambulances. Now they're deciding what they're going to do, and the decision is finally going to be made for them on what is happening out west, because we have, of course, General Longstreet would like to go west. He's a champion of the western idea. He had been in favor of it for some time, and he would like to go take his corps and go west. Now, the Union will force a fast decision on them, however. The Union troops of General Rosecrans will take the offensive on the 16th day of August and begin moving toward through the Cumberland Plateau toward Chattanooga. And General Burnside, who is up serviced out west, is looking pretty good as he takes the offensive in eastern Tennessee, in eastern Kentucky, moving into eastern Tennessee. Now they're going to find out this transfer of Longstreet has to take place fast, because on the second day of September, the Yankees capture Knoxville astride the direct route from Piedmont, Virginia, to the Chattanooga area. And it will be finally decided about the time that Lee is returning to the army that Longstreet is going now. And it begins on the night. So Lee's strength that he's built up to 60,000 men is going to be reduced by the loss of Longstreet's corps. And Longstreet is rather delighted to be getting away from General Lee, because he can see in his mind he'll go west, and there he'll win some glory, and in his mind he'll soon replace General Braxton Bragg in command out in the west. And beginning on the 9th of September, they begin to transfer, and it's a long roundabout way. Using multiple rail lines, many of the men going by way of Charleston, all of them again finally moving up to Chattanooga by way of Atlanta. And Lee will feel good when he reads that Longstreet, having arrived in North Georgia, they have beaten the Union rather badly at the Battle of Chickamauga. He's a little miffed and worried at first because the earlier reports are that Hood is dead and General Wofford is dead. Neither one of these are true. Hood is very badly wounded, and the Union fall back into Chattanooga, but Bragg does not follow up on it. The Union will now be weakening themselves, and that'll give Lee the opportunity to take the offensive. General Hooker has been without of a job since the administration had called his bluff when he threatened to resign unless they would give him charge of the troops in Harper's Ferry on the 27th day of June, going back to that. And he's been out of a job since then, and he's ordered to proceed west with two corps of the Army of the Potomac. The Army of the Potomac at this time is concentrated in Fauquier County, and soon they're going to soon be minus General Slocum's 12th Corps and General Howard's 11th Corps. And to show you again the difference in railroad lines, the Confederates are having serious problems with their railroads. It had taken the Confederates using the interior lines 10 days to get most of Longstreet's men out to northwest Georgia, and the Union will be leaving Warrenton on the 24th and the 25th of September, and they're going to be at Bridgeport, Tennessee by the last day in September. Now, General Lee is going to decide the opportunity is now ripe for taking the offensive. You can short turn on the first map on the slide there, or you can use the first two maps in your packet. Now the Confederate Army, following the departure of General Longstreet, had retired behind the Rapidan. Up until the departure of Longstreet, the Confederate front line had been the Rappahannock. When they retire behind the Rapidan River, General Meade will immediately move his men forward. Meade will establish his headquarters near Culpeper. His cavalry will move forward to James City, and there will be a number of cavalry clashes along the Rapidan River as we get into the fourth week of September. Now Lee is by the ninth. Lee is ready to take the offensive. Now, as his army is deployed behind the Rapidan, we have General Ewell on the right, and we have General Hill on the left, and Stuart has two divisions of cavalry. Now, Stuart in this period is going to wear two hats, the chief of cavalry in the Army of Northern Virginia, and he's going to command Hampton's division of cavalry. Hampton has got his head massaged on East Cavalry Field by a Union cavalryman, also been shot, and he's not back to duty. And Fitz Lee will be commanding the other division of cavalry. Fitz Lee's cavalry will be covering the Army's right as they prepare to move, and Stuart with Hampton's brigade will be covering the Army's left as they prepare to move. Now, what Lee is thinking the same way as he did back in August 1862, when everything looked good for the Confederates, and he had his two principal wing commanders, Jackson and Longstreet with him, who complimented both people. Now, I'm a good Monday morning quarterback, as everybody is here, and you're going to know that General Ewell and General A.P. Hill, hate to think they might be some of your relatives or heroes, they are very poor facsimiles of Generals Longstreet and General Jackson. He is also, and so, is going to use the same strategy, but he knows that Hill will never be able to march his men like Jackson did when Jackson does that march that begins on the 25th day of August and in less than 48 hours is going to put him at Bristol Station. So he knows he cannot do a wide turning movement against the enemy. He's going to have to do a short left hook. So on the 9th, the Confederates begin moving forward. And their mission is Hill will move forward and Ewell will move forward, and they will, by the evening of the 10th, they've reached Madison Courthouse. The Union cavalry has fallen back in front of General Stuart using Hampton's command, and Lee is now ready to begin a wide swing. General Meade at this time is holding Culpeper through Griffinsburg, and on the 10th, the Confederate Army starts moving forward. Now, as it moves forward, General Hill will be on the left, General Ewell on the right, and by the evening of the 10th, the Yankees have evacuated Culpeper and are falling back behind the Rappahannock River. The 11th is a good day in which Lee hopes has an opportunity at the on the morning of the on the during the day. The Union infantry moving along roads that parallel the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, and covering the, and of course Wade Fitzhugh Lee. Goal is to cross at Raccoon Ford and head north toward Brandy Station. General Stuart with his cavalry will march directly on Brandy Station, forcing the Union cavalry, commanded by Judson Kilpatrick, sitting there as they fall back. Judson and Custer are going to have a good day that day. This is a chance that the Confederate cavalry has of cutting off the Union cavalry. But the Union cavalry does well. Yes, there is another battle of Brandy Station, and it is not good for the Confederate plans, as Custer more than holds his own against Stuart's cavalry, against Fitz Lee moving north. And by the evening of the 11th, the Union cavalry has escaped, and the Union troops are behind the Rappahannock River. During the 11th, they begin their short left hook. There goes General A.P. Hill with his three divisions marching by way of Griffinsburg, Woodville, Sperryville, Little Washington, and they will not stop at that expensive restaurant when they get to Little Washington, if you think you're going to get a good meal. General Ewell will be following up. Going northward on the road that goes northward toward Jeffersonton. Meade is temporarily taken in by this. He loses the Federals, and on the 12th, he is going to order three of his corps, and his cavalry to cross the Rappahannock and advance to Brandy Station. He has lost the turning movement here of the Confederates as they move around his right flank. But by the evening of the 12th, you're going to wonder, what's wrong with our leaders if you're a Yankee? In the 1st Corps, now commanded by General Newton, if you're in the 2nd Corps, now commanded by General Warren, and if you're in the 3rd Corps, now commanded by the man of a thousand identities, General William French. The other Corps commanders are Uncle John Sedgwick and Tardy George Sykes. But finding out that the Confederates are around his flank, Ewell is passing through Jeffersonton. Hill is reaching Little Washington. He's definitely misread what the Confederates are doing. And Meade orders his men to fall back. They're going to destroy the bridge that carries the Rappahannock, carries the Orange and Alexandria Railroad across the Rappahannock. And they're going to retreat up the Orange and Alexandria Railroad to Warrenton Junction. So they have temporarily escaped the trap that Lee is the same strategy, only a very short left hook rather than that wide left hook that brought disaster to John Pope. And I would argue that Meade's a slightly better general than John Pope, than any of you people who may be Pope fans. I always remember John Pope best by the description of him given by Sam Sturgis. I do not give for John Pope a pinch of owl's dung. Well, on the 13th, it's going to look good for the Confederates because General Jubal Early is going to swing through Jeffersonton, cross the Rappahannock at Sulphur Springs, and by evening of the 13th, he is in Warrenton. Hill on that day will pass through Gaines Crossroads, Amosville, and crosses the Rappahannock at Waterloo Bridge, converging on Warrenton. By the evening of the 13th, Stuart and Fitz Lee's cavalry division are in a very tight situation. They have find themselves at Auburn Mills. The Union Army is moving along roads that parallel the Orange and Alexandria Railroad. And when Stuart is at Auburn Mills, he finds himself opposing the advance of the 3rd Corps, again commanded by our friend William French. Stuart will then find that the Union are now between he at Auburn Mills and Lee at Warrenton. Stuart is temporarily isolated between French's corps, which has passed through Auburn Mills and is on this road, and General Warren and the 2nd Corps, which has moved up from Warrenton Junction and come into Auburn Mills. During the night, Stuart will get a messenger through to General Lee. The messenger will arrive at Lee's headquarters and report that Stuart is isolated with Union soldiers on all sides of him. And Stuart urges Lee to use the closest troops, which is General Early, and start them at an early hour with Rhodes' division in the lead for Auburn Mills. Then if Stuart can hold his position there, they'll have the Union Army split. Stuart will spend a very uncomfortable night. The men will be ordered to stay up all night, hold their horses, try to keep them quiet, do not have them whinny or neigh, and we will stay there in the morning. On the morning of the 14th, you're going to have Stuart isolated. Fortunately, it is very foggy on the morning of the 14th, which is going to delay Rhodes's men as they move on Auburn Mills. And of course, moving up this way, we have moving by way of New Baltimore is General Hill, who will then turn and march to Greenwich. As we know, in that exciting morning, they can hear the smell of the bacon and the coffee. Stuart arranges his artillery to open fire as Caldwell's men brew their coffee. And then they'll stir their morning breakfast and repast when they open fire on them. The Unioners, considerable confusion, and Stuart will take advantage of this to extract Fitz Lee's division from entrapment. Now, the Confederates will now lose the Yankees, because Warren, having marched to Auburn, will then countermarch down to Catlett Station. And that means the Second Corps will be moving along this railroad, and the road paralleling, guarding the trains. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the 14th, you're going to find out how bad Hill is pretty quick. But Lee is because the Union troops are now crossing Broad Run. The last of the men to cross Broad Run are Tardy George Sykes with the wagon train. We're ready for the next map. Or you can turn to the third map if you're using the maps there. All right. Now, Tardy George Sykes, here, of course, is Broad Run. The railroad is operable, so the railroad bridge is functioning. You people have been out there, know once you cross Kettle Run here, the railroad passes through a cut. And the cut gets deeper and deeper as it goes west. The northwest. Tardy George's men have already crossed the Army's rear guard with the Army trains, the other three corps in advance of Tardy George. Now the Confederate Army is approaching. Now coming down from Greenwich will be the corps commanded by A.P. Hill. Ewell had grown up in that area. Although he was born in Georgetown, he had spent his young years out in the area of Greenwich. He knows the country roads, and it's been decided that he is going to move on farm roads that are going to be to the southwest of the ones Hill is moving on. Lee is not feeling well. He's been riding in an ambulance most of the day. And as Harry Heath's division, Harry Heath is a low man in the class of 1849, just like Custer was the lowest man in the class of the second class in 1861. Harry Heath is really not really one of the great generals, though he's reputedly one of the two generals in the army that Lee calls by his first name. Now, as they approach, no cavalry out in front, they're going to see from the high ground just north of the Noakesville Road now, they're going to see men moving over here. They see the wagon trains. And Heath after clearing with General Hill, decides we're going to intercept the trains. We're going to cross Broad Run in this area here and fall on the Union trains. And we're going to use two brigades to do it. You don't want to be in those two brigades. One on the left is going to be commanded by 5 North Carolina regiments, commanded by Brigadier General Kirkland. And on the right are going to be 4 Virginia regiments and 4 North Carolina regiments, commanded by Brigadier General Rogers Cook. And as they're advancing, Cook on the left sees something that nobody has seen. That is a Union column, an entire corps, moving along the road and along the railroad cut. Now, John Mackinaw's favorite lady, I think he would like to marry her at one time. Mrs. Rollins used to live right there.
That's one.
All right. He looks in that way, and he can see this column moving along here. This is a brigade commanded by Alex Webb, who commanded a brigade at Gettysburg. And out in front is Mallon's brigade, has the 42nd New York in it, such regiments as that, 20th Massachusetts, etc. And they then see them, and knowing that this is real trouble, they're now going to change their axis of advance from this way to this way, and try to reach the cut first. Unfortunately for the Confederates, they're not going to reach the cut first. And all the Yankees have to do is unlimber their cannons, Brown's battery, Ricketts' battery, Arnold's battery, and the Confederates have only one battery. And those Yankees are in the railroad cut. With artillery support, John Rogers Cook is wounded very quickly. His old regiment, the 27th North Carolina, 50% casualties. And Kirkland is suffering the same. In 60 minutes, it's all over. The Confederates have been beaten back. They've lost this battery, McIntosh's, as a Confederate counterattack. And Lee is not happy about it. He'll be a lot more unhappy the next day when he can find out what has happened. The Union will continue up the road, cross Bull Run. Meade will establish his headquarters at Centerville, and they're behind Bull Run. The next day when Lee will say, as he looks at the wreckage, the human wreckage of 1,300 men, the federal casualties about 250. He says General Hill will speak no more about it now, and you will bury these poor men. So again, Monday morning quarterbacking. I would argue that Hill had made the biggest mistake at Gettysburg that any Confederate general will make. So he's not batting very good. All right, next map. By the evening. All right, next map. We got to go a little faster. Well, we need a probably we have now the Federals by the evening of the 15th are behind Bull Run. Headquarters at in Centerville, and the Confederates have advanced up to Bull Run. Lee has to make some decisions now. Let's go back to the other map before that. The one I said pass. I thought there was a better map that we have. The one that I had. All right. The Federals have fallen back behind Bull Run. Lee will stay there until the night of the 17th. What should I do? The Union outnumbers them. They're using the old Confederate fortifications, simply refacing them at Centerville. I can't attack them. I can't get around their flanks. And I can't stay here in Prince William County because it's felt the hard hand of war. And the railroad bridge across the Rappahannock is destroyed, and we cannot bring up supplies. So Lee makes the decision, we're going back. Now on the 18th, they pull back from Bull Run. Most of the infantry are turned to tearing up the railroad. Every rail between Manassas Junction and the Rappahannock will be pulled up. The ties will be burned and the rails twisted. What the Yankees called Sherman Horseshoes. On the 19th, the Confederates in the audience can smile a little bit, because after that lacing that you just taken, you're going to have a success at Buckland. Now, Buckland, of course, is located here. There, of course, is Broad Run. And on the 19th, Stuart's cavalry, this is a division formerly would Wade Hampton's, are positioned astride the Warrenton Pike and covered by Broad Run. Wade Hampton is down here at Auburn with a detachment at Greenwich. And Judson Kilpatrick, right there he sits again, the man with a lantern jaw. And he's feeling aggressive that day. And using Davies' brigade and Custer's brigade, they're going to turn Stuart's flank. Now remember, Stuart is commanding Hampton's division. And Stuart will fall back along the road to New Baltimore, toward Chestnut Hill. And he'll be pursued by Davies' brigade. Custer is feeling pretty good because they've captured the headquarters wagon of Pierce Manning Butler Young, one of Hampton's brigade commanders. And Custer likes to capture that because he and Pierce Manning Butler Young have been classmates at West Point until Young resigns and goes north. So they're drawing off Judson Kilpatrick. The man whose objective is to be a successful playwright and president of the United States. he sees a good chance to get some to build up his morale, his credit line. He already has the nom de guerre, which he'd got at Hanover on the first day, on the 30th day of June, of Kill Cavalry. And he is not going to be, have no patrols out left and right as he heads toward New Baltimore. Fitz Lee is coming north. He sends the message to Stuart, and he says, I think we've got him trapped. Where I'm going to move up here to, in this area here where Vent Hill is, and move up the Vent Hill Road, and you have some parallel ridges there, and we're going to cut the SOB off. Well, Hampton moves up, puts his artillery in, parallel to him is Custer. And now Stuart is going to charge Kilpatrick. Kilpatrick will run, move his horses rather fast, 7 miles in what becomes known as the Buckland Races, in which you lose 250 prisoners and not enhance your reputation. But this gives the Confederates something to smile about. And the Confederates will continue their retreat. They'll continue to tear up the railroad as they fall back, and we'll go back to the next map. Meade will advance as far as Warrenton. He really wouldn't want to go any further because he has to rebuild the railroad as he goes forward. And he goes to Washington and he gets a pep talk from the president. The president, as commander-in-chief, is very worried. Maybe those Confederates will send more men out to General Bragg, out in, who are laying siege to Chattanooga. And this is a chance for us to punish General Lee. So General Meade, having had a pep talk with the president and General Halleck, will then, on the 6th of November, decide to press on to the Rappahannock. He's going to assign the main column that will advance along the railroad. The parallel road will consist of two corps. General Uncle John Sedgwick, commander of the 6th Corps, will command the Army's right wing, which consists of the 6th Corps and the 2nd Corps. The 3rd Corps, General French again, we know who he is, so I don't have to flash it on again. He will move to seize and expunge the Confederate and seize a crossing across the Rappahannock at Kelly's Ford. We'll deal with this one first. Now, with so the Confederates, when Lee had pulled back, the Confederates think maybe we're going into winter quarters. This may be the end of the campaign season. And the Confederates are building huts. This is probably when men in the church on the field of Brandy Station gets torn down. But they want to hold, if an opportunity comes, they want to hold a bridgehead on the east side of the river. So this is going to be established at Rappahannock Bridge. So they're going to lay a pontoon train, pontoon bridge. The railroad is, bridge is, of course, torn up. And the Confederates throw up a line of earthworks and redoubts on the far side of the Rappahannock. They'll put two on two knolls still there. They're going to place two batteries. One battery here, to support their friends on the other side. They have four guns and two redoubts here. And initially, it is only Harry Hayes's Louisiana Brigade, the Tigers. That will be the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Louisiana. And these guys think they're good. You're full of baloney if you think, the Texans are full of baloney if they think the Texas Brigade is the best. The Tigers are the best. They've inherited the name and the reputation of the Tigers from those men from the 1st Special Battalion, commanded by Robert O. Wheat, who had the two men executed and buried out here in December 1861. So they're the best fighters, best swearers, and the best men to make it out with the women in the army, is their opinion. So they're tough boys. They've inherited all the good points and none of the bad points of the 1st Special Battalion. And they call themselves the Tigers. Well, Lee is up there that day, late in the afternoon on the 7th, with Jubal Early. And they decide that maybe, since the Union are advancing, but since it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, people don't fight at night. So we say Lee would have to be party to what is going to happen. They're going on the assumption that in the Civil War, people don't attack at night. So they're going to tell Saint Hoke's Brigade, commanded by Colonel Godwin, consisting of the 54th North Carolina, 6th North Carolina, 57th North Carolina. That means you now have over 2,000 men in a bridgehead with four guns. The Union will advance as a skirmish line. They're going to have, the hero of the Union is going to be David Russell. And our friend, Colonel Upton. Upton is commanding Russell's brigade. Russell is commanding Horatio Wright's division, and Horatio Wright is commanding the 6th Corps. Now, these fellows are the guys who stormed Marie's Heights on the third day of May 1863. They know that if you take advantage of the terrain, you can storm a strong position. And what Upton and Russell see this day, is the same type of attack they're going to use when Upton breaks Dole Salient, where you're going to be next week, I believe, when you're in Spotsylvania. That is, when it gets dark, when it's getting dark, the enemy won't think we're going to do it. We're going to send forward the 6th Maine skirmishers. Follow them with men in line of battle, and they're going to attack this redoubt. Moving on their left, right is going to be Emory Upton with his regiment, the 121st New York, and the 5th Maine, who will spearhead that attack at Dole Salient, which they carry. And Lee and Ewell don't realize what's really happened. It's so fast. They don't stop the Union. They keep coming. And as you can see, they're going to storm the redoubt held by the 8th Louisiana. And Upton's going to storm the section held by the 54th North Carolina. And these guys are going to reach that Ponton Bridge pretty fast. And that means a lot of you rebels aren't going to get out of there. You're going to have four guns captured. You're going to lose 1,600 of the 2,000 men in there. And the Union losses are going to be around 200. So we'll zap that. That's a bad day for Lee. Any lot Lee and the Confederates have of wintering in Culpeper County are slim and none. Next slide. Next picture. All right. Now in your map pack, you have the storming and the Union troops under William French punishing Dobson Ramsour down at Kelly's Ford. This had happened earlier today. Did you find that map in your pack? Yes. I think it is in there, supposed to be. Let me see. Let me hold it up. All right, it's in there. This gentleman is holding it up. There, they're going to do a different strategy. General French is one of the best, at one time, was on artillery board, along with Henry Hunt. So he is a good artillerist. He may be a heavy drinker, known as a walking brandy barrel, or old Blinky, because he has one eye blinks all the time, and he's overweight. But he knows how to use artillery. You're going to see they're going to mass four batteries of artillery on the covering the crossing is the 2nd North Carolina, tough luck North Carolina today, and holding back there 300 yards inland is the 30th North Carolina, and those cannons are going to open fire. They're going to hammer you. And Casper Trepp with the 1st and 2nd U.S. sharpshooters. Spirited attack. And we've got across the river there. We've captured over 360 Confederates. And we've lost a handful ourselves. All right. So with this, Lee has to say, we can't stay in Culpeper County. So on the 8th, the Confederates retreat behind the Rapidan River. They're back where they were on the 9th of October, back behind the Rapidan, and they're sortie northward. They carried them to Bull Run, has cost the Confederates 4,000 men. The Union casualties during that campaign, less than 1,000. So the Army of Northern Virginia isn't quite its old self, I would say, and Lee knows it. Well, Lee is certain that his men, that the campaign is over. So the Confederates go into winter quarters behind the Rapidan River. General Jules, 2nd Corps will be on the right, defending the area from Morton's Ford, Raccoon Ford, and Hill will be on the left. The other crossings, Ely's Ford, Germanna Ford, Jacobs Ford, will be guarded by cavalry. Well, Meade would like to go into winter quarters too. But Lee has to go for guidance. Meade would like to be in winter quarters, and Union troops would damn sure be in winter quarters. But Meade gets called to Washington for guidance and counseling again. And that isn't the president's idea. And in Washington, they're very worried. Because as you get into the last week of November, things are coming to a head in East Tennessee. General Longstreet has been detached and sent to Knoxville. And he's going to have a very, very unpleasant days up there along at Knoxville at that time. And Grant has arrived before Chattanooga, heavily reinforced, and he's going to deal with General Bragg on the 23rd through the 25th of November. But you don't know in Washington that's going to work out that well. We don't know that things are going to come unraveled bad for the Confederates in East Tennessee. So the president tells Meade, gets marching orders. You are not going into winter quarters. You're going to take the offensive again. Meade is very reluctant to do it, but he, unlike General McClellan, he knows who the commander-in-chief is. So he comes back. General Sedgwick has been in command of the army. He's been gone. And when he comes back, he's going to tell Sedgwick, I got bad news for you. We're going to take the offensive. We're going to advance on the 24th of November. We're going to go into a high rate of security so the enemy will not know what we're going to do. Now, his plan is, on the morning of the 25th, General Governor K. Warren with the Second Corps, commanded by Governor K. Warren, who is soon going to be on Meade's Super S list. Preceded by David McMurtry's Gregg's Cavalry Division, followed by Sykes's and Newton's Corps, will cross at Germanna Ford. The wagon trains will cross at Culpeper Mine Ford, not shown on the map, halfway between Ely's Ford and Germanna Ford. Crossing at Jacob's Ford, want to hear a big herald of trumpets, will be the Third Corps, spearheaded by William French, supported by Sedgwick's Sixth Corps. That's 40% of the army, 30,000 men. But you think you're going to get a reprieve for 2 days, because it's going to rain real hard on the night of the 24th. So they're going to reset the march, the movement to begin on the 26th. But in that time, Lee is beginning to find out from stragglers, from his scouts, that something is up. He is not sure what it is. Well, the 26th opens. You're going to have a lot more men die of the cold, pneumonia, and various things associated with bad weather than will die of lead poisoning in the next days. Well, let's say the wagon trains get across at Gregg's, people at Culpeper Mine Ford. Warren, supported by the first and the Newton and the First Corps, and Tardy George and the Second Corps are going to cross at Germanna. But French has trouble. The weather is bad. The Ford is not good. He ain't a very great general. And he's not going to get across. That means that Sedgwick doesn't cross either on the 26th. That gives Lee 1 day. And you don't give Lee time to... you don't give him time. Bonaparte said time's the most important thing a general can have. So Lee has pretty well fathomed what is coming. So he's going to tell General Ewell, I want you to put your men in motion. And I want you to send Allegheny Johnson, old Clubby, with his division across the Rapidan at Raccoon Ford. And move him westward, eastward, through Bartlett's Mill. Mine run is this water course here. Mine run is not much depth, but as it flows north, it flows through a deeper and deeper trench as it goes north. And I want you to take your other divisions. I want you to take Robert Rhodes' division, and I want you to march them by way of Zor Church to Locust Grove. General Hill, I'm going with you. I don't know whether Lee says this or not, but he goes at the wilderness, he goes with Hill. You can tell who he thinks his weak corps commander is. He says, I'll be with you. And Dolly thinks, since Lee wouldn't use a horrible name, but if he used, if he was using rough gutter language, he says, I'll make sure you don't screw up again. Well, on the 27th, our hero, General French, gets across at Jacob's Ford. Sedgwick will be trailing a long way behind him, roads muddied, moving through rough countryside. And about noon, French's vanguard is going to be beyond Cross Mine Run, be moving across level ground in here, but heavily wooded, and has passed beyond this intersection. Out in front, Johnson has a brigade commanded by John Marshall Jones, known as Rum. He had taken the pledge when he's been promoted to brigadier general. He'd been a staffer. He's followed by a Louisiana brigade, Safford's, followed by the Stonewall Brigade, commanded by Stonewall Jim Walker, with Marilyn Stewart bringing up the rear with a battalion of artillery. Now we'll get the other people and then we're going to fight this battle. Well, the wagon trains are going to get across, move to Wilderness Run. Warren is going to cross here, and Warren by noon has reached Locust Grove, where he's supposed to be joined by General French, and then by General Sedgwick, and you got 60% of your army in a position. Cavalry, Gregg, leading the Sykes, have moved into this area here, New Hope Church, Good Hope Church. Next map. Okay. All right. There's the north arrow, of course. The Orange Plank Road runs from west to east. There is Mine Run. All right. All right, leave that map on, and he is going to hold up the map you should be using now. It's going to show Payne's Farm. Payne's Farm. You have Payne's Farm in your packet. He's holding it up there. He's holding it up there. Everybody that finds Payne's Farm, hold it up there. We'll use this map very shortly. Well, the Confederates are moving along the Raccoon Ford Road, heading for Locust Grove. Coming down from Jacob's Ford is Prince's Division. When the fighting starts, although Johnson has only 5,400 men, he is going to deploy them, as I said, from right to left along the Raccoon Ford Road. On the right, John Marshall Jones, right center, Safford, left center, Stonewall Jim Walker. On the left, Marilyn Stewart and artillery. Now, although the Yankees are going to bring up Prince's Division, Carr's Division, Birney's Division, and have available Sedgwick late in the day, the Confederates will hold the ground and you will not get to Locust Grove. There'll be rumors that French is drunk. Well, the Union plan is coming unraveled. The 27th, they have not concentrated. On the 28th, Meade prepares to advance, and the Confederates have fallen back behind Mine Run. The Yankees will reconnoiter on the 29th. And on the 30th, the Confederates will entrench. And here we have Ewell on the right with his three divisions, A.P. Hill on the left. Warren will reconnoiter on the 30th. At that time, the Confederate left does not extend as far south as it is on the morning of the 31st. So Warren is going to be the star. French is an eclipse. So Warren will be given command of his second corps, two divisions of French's corps, and one division and Newton. So he's got Terry. So he has 60% of the army. Now their plan is, when at 8 o'clock in the morning, Warren will attack the Confederate right. As soon as they hear Warren's guns, Sedgwick will attack the rebel left. Warren is out reconnoitering. The position looks stronger. They've extended their right. Now he has a great challenge. What's he going to do? The men are not liking the looks of it. Like at Cold Harbor, men begin to write their names on their blouses. Warren is then going to face the situation that generals have to face. It's his plan. He's been given 60% of the army, and will he order an attack? Well, all the men and their families will be glad when he says no attack. Sedgwick will get tired of waiting. His guns will open fire. He hears nothing over there. And Warren comes up and tells Meade, "I've taken it upon myself not to order attack." Meade is beside himself. And probably the route that Warren will finally end up at Five Forks begins that day. Because at Cold Harbor, Meade wants to fire him at Cold Harbor. By Five Forks, Grant wants to fire him and finds a man to fire him. Well, on the so there's no attack. Meade has to go back and face the wrath of the War Department and the President. They disengage on the night of the 1st, and by the 2nd, the Union troops are back on the north side of the Rapidan, and the armies go into winter quarters. In the campaign, discounting the much larger numbers who have died of exposure, the Federals have lost 1,200 men, the Confederates 700. The armies are now in winter quarters and will remain there except for such activities as a Dahlgren Kilpatrick ride, a resort organization of the army that will see General French depart from the army as they consolidate division, a corps, and General Sykes depart. And the reorganization of the Army of the Potomac will see it reduced from 5 corps to 3 corps. Second, 5th, and 6th. The 1st Corps disappears into the 5th Corps. The 3rd Corps disappears into the 2nd Corps. They face a mutiny over it for a while in February. These guys are proud of their corps, and they're proud of their badges, but they let them keep the badges. If you're in the 3rd Corps, you'll still wear the diamond rather than the trefoil. If you're in the 1st Corps, forming the 1st Corps, you'll wear the circle rather than the Greek cross. This takes place before Grant shows up. As the Union prepare for their offensive, we'll have another map, they have the last map, the Union will prepare for the offensive, and this, of course, will see the Army of the Potomac. We'll have about 118,000 men organized into 4 corps. Now, 1 corps does not report to General Meade. That is the 9th Corps, commanded by General Burnside, which has returned from East Tennessee. Grant doesn't see him quite the klutz that Meade does, because after all, he had beaten General Longstreet at the Battle of Knoxville. So he will report directly to Army headquarters. When the Army takes the field in the spring, think of General Eisenhower.
May I have your attention, please? The library will close at 9 o'clock. If you need to apply for a library card, please go to the checkout desk now. Thank you.
We've got plenty of time. Think of General Eisenhower having General Marshall showing up on the 17th day of December, looking over his right shoulder. That's the situation Meade is going to find himself in the entire campaign. General Grant, General-in-Chief of the Army, looking over his right shoulder. The campaign, of course, will begin on the night of the 2nd and 3rd of May. And again, we'll be back to the Rapidan. Now the Army of the Potomac, as they prepare to take the offensive, General Meade's headquarters will remain at Brandy Station. Grant is symbolic, will establish his headquarters. The headquarters of the Army of the United States will be at Culpeper. He wants to show that he is closer to the front than General Meade. 6th Corps of General Sedgwick, headquarters north of Brandy Station, Hancock has returned to duty. Remember? You didn't hear of him up to that moment. First time I've mentioned him tonight. One of my heroes. Because he's recovering from his Gettysburg wound. He recovers from his Gettysburg wound in the spring, in February, and his Second Corps goes into camp north of Stevensburg. Warren's Fifth Corps goes into camp near Culpeper. Burnside should really be further back. Burnside's, we'll have to chastise who drew this map, Burnside's headquarters are at Warren. And remember, he reports directly to General Grant, the General Chief of the Army, and he'll do that up to the fourth week of May when Grant gets tired of playing nursemaid to General Burnside and in essence says, forget it, you can report to General Meade, I don't care what you think about it. The Army now is headed, the cavalry was headed now by General Sheridan, and they're positioned when the advance begins on the night, as soon as it goes dark on the night of the 3rd, General Warren, spearheaded by the cavalry, commanded by Grant's protege, James Harrison Wilson. Harry. Now, Wilson would be gone from the Army in the first week if he wasn't Grant's protege, because he's going to make every bad move you can think of during the first week. So they will be here and crossing Germanna Ford, the cavalry, just as it gets daybreak. Traveling with General Meade, who will cross that, is Colonel Lyman. Wonderful book. I advise you to, one of the best books that has come out this year is his heretofore unpublished manuscript. Not that manuscript, sanitized one you read that came out many years ago. And as he watches the Army cross, he theorizes, if every man had a white armband, what it would look like. If they have a white, if every man is going to fall in the next 5 weeks, if he had a white armband, what it would look like. One third of them won't be there. Another man speculates that Grant's accompanied by his patron, Elihu Washburn. And he wears very severe black clothes, and other soldiers will speculate it's going to be bad in the wilderness because Grant has brought his personal armed undertaker along. Well, General Hancock will move from Madden's, Richardville, spearheaded by Corbett's cavalry, New Jersey man, will cross at Ely's Ford, and by 10:30 we'll be at Chancellorsville. General Sedgwick, late in the day on the 4th, will follow Warren across the Germanna Ford, and nightfall on the 4th we'll find Warren camped in a round Wilderness Tavern, and Hancock and Sedgwick camped near where the Culpeper Mine Road goes off. Burnside will arrive at Germanna Ford and cross on the 5th. Lee, where is he? Now, Lee will spend a long winter. His army will be having difficult being fed even. He has to disperse his cavalry. A horse requires 5-10 to keep a horse working requires 10 pounds of forage and 10 pounds of fodder, and they're getting 5 pounds a day, so they have to grub for the rest. Now, unfortunately for the Federals, the Confederate Army, General Hill, has camped from the railroad westward, Ewell from the railroad downstream beyond Morton's Ford. Longstreet is camped at Gordonville. Now, if the Yankees had started the campaign 2 weeks before, Longstreet would not have been back from Tennessee, and things might have gone much different. But it's not. Now, Lee, on the second, had been up on Clark Mountain. Good place then by tour. Lee had been on Clark Mountain in the third week, beginning of the third week of August 1862. And he could look out over Culpeper County. There he could see the camps of General Pope. Now he looks out and sees camps occupied by twice as many Federals. And then he makes his plans for what he's going to do. Intercept the enemy in the wilderness. And he's going to have his corps moving on the morning of the 4th. Just like he did before, General Ewell moving by the Orange Turnpike. By evening, he is going, of the evening of the 4th, he's going to be at Robertson's Tavern. Hill will be moving by the Orange Plank Road again. Who's traveling with him? Shows who he considers his weak corps commander. He is traveling with General Hill. They'll spend the night near Madeirasville, and Longstreet is moving by way of the Pamunkey Road. So that will show that after 6 months, the Federals are again crossing the Rapidan. And that's what you're going to find out. Is it going to be a failure like it was at the Battle of Mine Run? And will they return north of the Rapidan? Or will they go on and on and on? Unfortunately for the good Confederates here, they go on and on and on. And as long as the president sustains Ulysses S. Grant, they'll go on. And you will have them ending up, the two great leaders of the war, in Wilbur McLean's parlor at 3:30 in the afternoon on Palm Sunday, April 9th, 1865. Thank you for your attention. Yes, General French.
And where was French assigned, or what position did he hold just before he replaced the...
Your hero. Your alter ego, I should say. Has no command. When they consolidate the Third Corps into the Second Corps, he commands in essence a large wooden desk with nothing.
What happened when Dan Sickles was wounded? How did he get the job then?
Okay, when Sickles is wounded, David B. Birney will take over the Third Corps. Sickles does not come back. He would like to come back, but Meade doesn't want him back. And it doesn't preclude you coming back with a limb amputated, but Meade doesn't want him back. But even before he comes back, they'll make French commander of the Third Corps.
French had been
a division commander in the Army of the Potomac at the Battle of Antietam. So he had been on other assignments, maybe to the artillery bureau, and they bring him back out of that to command the Third Corps.
Other questions? I'm sure you have questions. Think now. Just relax. Come to you.
Says my good friend, the General Depew, is a man of 1,000 personalities. Now, of course, since we made him, when he's Judson Kilpatrick, he can think of who his granddaughter is. The Gloria Vanderbilt Stokowski.
Oh.
And his great great-great-great-grandson, you see him on television all the time. Anderson Cooper.
Going back to Governor Warren, Kay Warren, you mentioned several times he was on the verge of being relieved. Laurel Hill, after he was also on the verge of being
relieved. All right, well, we could go on to Laurel Hill. I would say we could look. He does not. He's an example of a great staff officer that does not make. Of course, he'd been a credible brigade commander, but he lacks certain problems when he becomes a corps commander. He did well, but anybody could have done well. I'll submit. At the Battle of Bristow Station. But again and again, he does not get along with his subordinates. Charles Griffin and he have some terrible shouting matches, and he doesn't. He's very nervous, and Meade is ready. During the Cold Harbor, things are going bad, and he's almost asking Meade, "Can I go to the bathroom?"
You seem very critical of his decision.
What?
You seem very critical of Governor K. Warren's decision not to attack Mine Run.
No, I wasn't really critical there. I said he got on Meade's. I said, don't you remember? I said, if you guys were the mothers and the fathers of these people, they were probably very delighted. But Meade is furious at him for not attacking because he says you made me look bad.
But don't you think it was a gutsy decision?
I think Warren took a courageous decision there, because that's why I said, talking about the mothers and fathers are glad he did, but he put himself, I think, in a position where Meade lacks confidence in him.
Along that line, didn't he set up Meade, because he was the one prior to the 30th of November was encouraging Meade for him to get the preponderance of the strength.
It was his plan.
Yeah, he said that he could outflank.
He sold Meade the plan. And Meade gives him three divisions in addition to his own. And French, of course, goes berserk over it.
Other side of the coin, A.P. Hill. It seemed like he did pretty well earlier.
All right.
Out of his depth.
Yes. If we didn't have the Peter principle, we could have had the Hill principle. He has real problems when he becomes a corps commander. He has serious physical problems. And I would argue he may have some mental problems, psychological problems. Because he has, you were in the old Navy, you'd know all about it. He had prostatitis. And that is, in the old Navy, which you were in, that was known having old Joe, which they call gonorrhea in the old Navy or in the old Marine Corps, and it went down on you, which means they gave you adhesions in your duct that goes from your kidneys to your bladder. And I understand it feels like a kidney stone.
Another question down here?
Yes, sir.
What's the difference between Hancock?
What?
How would you say Hancock performed before Gettysburg and after he returned in this period?
Well, Gettysburg. Hancock is wounded very badly at Gettysburg. He is writing. Everybody likes me to do this rendition of it. He's sitting in his saddle.
The library will close.
The bullet hits, goes to the pommel of his saddle. He has heavy thighs, so people who have heavy thighs can sympathize with him. Because the bullet goes in 6 inches through flesh and muscle and lodges against his tailbone. Carrying shatters bone, which rots in you, gives you osteomyelitis, which is tuberculosis of the bone. So he ends up with tuberculosis of the bone. Very painful. And during the campaign and the overland campaign, he will periodically have to go on sick leave because the wound will break open, drain pus and blood. He'll go into the invalid corps starting in at the end of his last campaign with the Army of the Potomac is the Battle of the Boyden Plank Road, 26th and 27th of October of 64. His next active campaign is in the field of 1867 on the plains. He's a disaster on the plains because he's fighting the Indians using infantry tactics. But he's one good break is that his wound breaks open and a piece of rotten bone comes out, which has been causing the wound to break open and suppurate. And after that, it never breaks open again. And he lives to be, but he doesn't live to be very old.
Question back there.
Ambrose Burnside, do you think his conduct in command of the Ninth Corps ever caused him to deserve the rank of being a corps commander?
Burnside will remain in command of the Ninth Corps till about 3 weeks after the crater. And 3 weeks after the crater, Burnside is detached from command of the Ninth Corps and is assigned to John G. Park. And
do you think he should have been a corps commander at all?
What?
Should he have been a corps commander at all? Mm-hmm. How do you rate him as a corps commander?
As a corps commander in the Army of the Potomac, he is considered the weakest of the four corps commanders. And after the crater, you could say Meade and Grant, maybe they should have taken some of the blame when they overrule him on using the blacks. But there has to be a scapegoat for it, and he'll be the scapegoat and be relieved.
One more question.
And he will not have any more command assignments in the war. He'll end up being a senator from Rhode Island.
One last chance. Going, gone. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes.
Just keep that laser pointer there, will
you? Huh?
Keep the laser pointer. That's yours.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And Ed, we'd like to give you a check. It's nowhere close to what we think you're worth.
Well,
we'd like to make it.
Give it to a preservation group.
To what?
Give it to a preservation group.
To a preservation group.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate it. That was great.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That was a taxing challenge over 6 months. I'm sorry.
See, this is an old Navy man, so he knows what old Joe is. He knows about if it goes down on you.